society can be observed to this day. One of the early cases of police racism can be traced back to the early 1700s when South Carolina launched America's first law enforcement force, dubbed the Slave Patrol. As the title suggests, the patrols were tasked with hunting down black people and selling them into slavery. Following a devastating civil war, slavery in the U.S. was abolished in 1865, but the results the anti-slavery camp was looking for didn't come to pass. Wealthy plantation owners in the South found loopholes in the 13th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution and created what later became known as the Black Codes, the rules and regulations that appeared to have acknowledged the abolition but created the same slavery conditions in essence. Among the many racist provisions in the codes is the criminalization of vagrancy for black people. This meant that law enforcement was free to arrest and charge any black person who didn't have a job. The codes were a precursor to Jim Crow laws, which enforced racial segregation in the South and lasted until the mid-20th century. The recent killings and mistreatment of the black people are reminiscent of the lynching of African Americans and the destruction of their properties by the Ku Klux Klan and other hate groups throughout the years.
So I guess the main root is, you know, this country has been founded on a system of white supremacy, racism, and genocide. It's founded on a system of inequality with a purpose, right? Racism with a purpose. The purpose is to create a group of second class citizens who the country can feed off of, right? We can feed off of their labor, we can feed off of their work, we can feed off of their existence.
U.S. President Joe Biden staked much of his presidency on a promise to fight racism in the country, managing to garner the support from a large portion of the African American society. But with many lawmakers balking at even the idea of police reforms, can the president make good on his pledge?
You know, police reform and police brutality is a big issue for black and brown folks and for poor and working class folks here in the United States. But the U.S. politicians don't represent those people or those interests in this country. They represent a rich interest, the rich interest of the ruling class. And so, you know, they're not interested in police reform. So this bill, you know, essentially has died in the Senate and will probably never get passed because of the fact that, you know, there's no interest by U.S. policymakers to get it passed. There's no interest to do what the citizens want them to do.
George Floyd wasn't the first African-American who lost his life over what could otherwise be considered as an inconsequential offense for a white person, and certainly has not been the last. But the waves of scrutiny such cases bring up in their wake are indeed making a positive, albeit limited, impact.
Vienna's Palais Coburg Hotel, the venue of marathon talks between Iran and the P4+1 group. It has once again become the center of a lot of attention as parties involved in the tough negotiations have signaled significant progress despite the complexity of some issues. The eighth round, which began on December 27th, has now become one of the longest rounds of talks between Iran and the P4+1, namely Russia, China, Britain, France, and Germany. Iran and the P4+1 are completing a draft text of an agreement to revive the 2015 deal. Most of the delegations acknowledge that the talks have reached a critical stage. The diplomacy seems to be approaching a make-or-break moment. Iran's lead negotiator says being near the finish line does not guarantee crossing it. Ali Bagheri-Kani says it requires extra caution, much perseverance, additional creativity, and a balanced approach to take the last step. The Iranian diplomat points out that to finish the job, there are certain decisions that the Western parties to the negotiations need to take.
Thus far, the West has been reluctant to make any sweeping political decisions that are necessary to bring the United States back into the plan. Iran isn't just going to forget the very many U.S. and Western provocations since the United States left the plan in 2018, and they understand that there are many political camps competing at once for power. The West needs to make sweeping political decisions that will definitively outline the future of U.S. involvement in the plan.
Iran says its initiatives pave the way for the progress in the negotiations and that a good deal is within reach in the Austrian capital. Tehran believes that the ball is now in the West's court, and if it shows serious determination, a good deal can emerge. Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says Tehran seeks a lasting deal, not a fragile one. The president has noted that credible guarantees, putting an end to political claims and effective removal of sanctions are necessary for a lasting deal with the P4+1 group. But what are the characteristics of a lasting deal? The 2015 deal lasted a few years only. Even during the years that the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was in place, Iran had serious grievances about its implementation by Western parties. It complained that it was not receiving the economic benefits it was entitled to. And Iran seems to have learned a lesson from how the hard-earned international agreement unraveled. Since the beginning of the talks in Vienna last year, Iran has insisted that America must remove all sanctions imposed on Tehran after former U.S. President Donald Trump unilaterally pulled out from the deal in May 2018 in a verifiable manner. It has also demanded that Washington provide guarantees that it will not leave the JCPOA again.
Iran wants credible guarantees from the United States because the U.S. has failed to provide any critical guarantees, any credible guarantees, since the beginning of these negotiations. When the JCPOA was first being planned and negotiated back in 2015, the United States made a commitment to diplomacy and peace. Yet, in 2018, they proved that that commitment was not a guarantee by dropping out after the change of an administration. So what we find is that when Iran is talking to the United States and other Western nations that change their administrations often, and those administrations are subject to changing their positions from the last administration, then you find that Iran doesn't have any solid guarantees.
Iran says America's maximum pressure campaign has failed, and its credibility has been seriously deterred. Observers believe Washington now has to take measures to compensate for its past mistakes and regain the trust of the international community.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. we are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Since the topic is the rules of prayer, particularly speaking, we were talking about doubts, especially in the previous episode, especially approaching the end of that episode. We promise our audience, Sheikh Javid, to talk about some of those doubts that should be ignored while offering the prayer. We just started talking about those doubts that should be ignored, such as the topic of the frequent doubter, Kathir al-Shak. Would you continue talking about those doubts, please?
Well, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. There are certain and a number of doubts which must be ignored, and these are very helpful for a person.
Mm-hmm.
If a person knows how to handle his doubts, I think it will be in his benefit.
Yes.
A doubt about an action whose mm-hmm. time of performance has already passed, like for example during ruku, a person yes. doubts as to whether he has done or he has recited Surah Al-Hamd or not, or he has recited Surah Ikhlas or not, because he is doing ruku and he mm-hmm. cannot repeat the ruku.
Yes.
So since the time has passed, he should ignore his doubt
mm-hmm.
and assume that he has recited the zikr. Even
yes.
if he later understands or realizes that he did not recite hamd and the zikr, of course his prayer still remains valid.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. his prayer remains in order.
When we are talking about doubts, Sheikh Javed, basically we are talking about 50-50 chance, right?
Yes.
If any part, any scale, any end of this scale, in fact, goes over or higher than the other one, like 40-60, then that's not considered as a doubt, right?
Yeah, that's not considered. That's called a strong feeling.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then you have to act according to your feeling, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay.
Yes. That's why the religious authorities have expressly stated in their books that we have time to think a little bit. We should not rush. Okay, mm-hmm. When we have doubt, we should think to come to a conclusion. Maybe we will, if we think deeply and more carefully, we will come to a conclusion. And based on that conclusion or that strong feeling, we can act.
Yes, thank you.
Now, as far as the next doubt which must be ignored by us is concerned, of course, doubt which occurs after the salam of prayer. We know that the prayer ends with salam and it starts with niyyah and takbiratul ihram, of course. But after you have said salam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, then you start doubting whether I have offered 2 rakats or 3 rakats, whether I have, you know, done the prayer or performed the prayer correctly or mm-hmm. not. All of these doubts, no matter what the category of the doubt, mm-hmm. okay, whether it deals with the rukun of the prayer or whether it deals with the number of the rakats of the prayer, of course, all these doubts, the doubts about all these must be ignored. This is number 2. Mm-hmm. And then number 3, doubts after the time of prayer has already passed. Now you have left the prayer.
Yes.
You have left the prayer. And after a few minutes, you start doubting whether you have done, you offered the prayer correctly or not. Of course, that doubt must be ignored.
Yes.
Okay. And then we have doubt of a person who doubts too much. Okay.
Yes.
I think we talked about it in the previous episode, and I said that a person who is considered to be kasiru shak, or a person who doubts very often, mm-hmm. very often, must ignore his doubt. He should give the benefit of the doubt to himself. Okay. If a person is offering, for example, prayer, and he doubts whether he has offered, let's say, 4 rakats of prayer or 5 rakats of the prayer,
yes.
he should give the benefit of the doubt mm-hmm. to himself.
I see.
And of course, we have a lot of such people who doubt very often, and they try to, you know, repeat their prayers, not understanding what it means to ignore one's doubt in mm-hmm. the state of, you know, when one is doubting very frequently.
Yes.
So it's very important to understand and to practice this law, and to ignore one's doubt when one is. And who is a kasiru shak? A kasiru shak.
Yes. Let me.
I think this is very important to understand,
exactly.
Because many people wonder as to who a kasiru shak is, or who is a person who doubts very, very frequently.
Yes.
A person who doubts 3 times in the same prayer.
Yes.
In the same prayer, is a kasiru shak. And also a person who doubts 3 times in 3 consecutive prayers.
Uh-huh.
Prayers, then he is considered to be a kasiru shak.
Okay.
But it has also been said by the religious authorities that one should be in normal situation. Now, if because of anxiety or because of fear, because of certain reasons, if a person doubts 3 times in the same prayer, he is not considered to be a kasiru shak.
Because that would be like doubting randomly, right?
Randomly, yes.
Not a frequent type of doubt or doubter.
Right.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's take a short break and we'll be back. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Mohan Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javed, our dear guest speaker at the studio, talking about the rules of prayer according to Ayatollah Khamenei. Particularly speaking, we're talking about the doubts that should be ignored. Would you continue, please?
Well, the doubt by the imam, one who leads a, a congregational prayer about the number of the rakats of prayer. When the ma'mum or the follower knows the number of the rakats, okay?
Yes.
Must be ignored by the prayer leader. Mm-hmm. Now the prayer leader doubts whether I have done two rakats or three rakats, but the people standing behind him knows the number of the rakats. So they, the people behind him or the ma'mum can just indicate or just communicate to, to the imam somehow.
Get it across, yes.
Yeah. That to tell him that he is that to tell him the exact number of the rakats of the prayer. So this kind of doubt also must be ignored. Whether the doubt whether it is the imam who doubts or whether it's the ma'mum who doubts.
Yes.
So the doubt must be ignored. And when it comes to the last doubt which occurs in mustahab prayers or in the doubts which occurs in namaz ihtiyat, okay, in the prayer which is offered as a measure of precaution.
Mm-hmm.
So doubts, generally speaking, in mustahab prayer must be ignored, okay?
Yes.
Because mustahab prayer is mustahab in itself, in of and per se it's mustahab.
Yes.
So the doubts are not going to be obligatory. You are not going to pay attention to the doubts.
I see. Okay. How about this kind of doubt, Sheikh Javid, if somebody is offering the prostration part of the prayer, all right?
Yes.
And he or she doubts whether he or she has performed the ruku or not.
Yeah.
What is he or she supposed to do there?
Well, this is just an example of the doubt which occurs after the time of prayer has already passed.
Yes.
You know, we did discuss this, that if a person doubts about an act whose time of performance has passed, he should ignore his doubt. And when someone is doing sujood and he doubts whether he has done the ruku or not, he should simply ignore his doubt. And he cannot reverse, go perform the ruku and then do the sujood again, because it will be an addition of a rukun. Because if you add a rukun to the prayer, forgetfully or deliberately or intentionally, the prayer becomes void. You cannot add or you cannot omit a rukun to the prayer.
Okay, thank you very much, Shabit, for your nice answers and shedding a light on the questions regarding the prayer. And particularly speaking, in this program, we were talking about the doubts, especially the doubts that should be ignored. In this episode of Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to this program. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim عليه السلام. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. And Imam Musa al-Kazim was the seventh divinely appointed Imam among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim was the son of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far ibn Muhammad as-Sadiq alayhi salam. Now, when we talk about Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam, we see historically that he left an amazing legacy full of goodness, righteousness, beauty, and he was a brilliant guide for the community in general. And among the unique aspects that marked Imam al-Kazim's personality is his steadfastness and determination, his perseverance in front of the difficult events and the ordeals showered upon him by his contemporary tyrants. Old and young have an amazing opportunity to learn to how to deal with life's difficulties by looking into the life of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam. These are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام إن العاقل رضي بالدون من الدنيا مع الحكمة ولم يرضى بالدون من الحكمة مع الدنيا فلذلك ربحت تجارتهم.
Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam stated, Verily the man of intellect contents himself with less worldly things when accompanied with wisdom and does not content himself with less wisdom and more worldly things. And this is why their trade of the transient for permanent profits him.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the beautiful golden conversations of this divinely appointed Imam, Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim alayhi salam, we find that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam spoke to his companions in these conversations about certain principles and certain tenets of Islam, and tenets that if one lives by them, they will attain true salvation. In one instance, Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam ordered his companions to speak the truth and to show the truth, and likewise to refrain from falsehood. Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam responded to his companions and said, Fear Allah and say the truth, though therein is your destruction. For in reality, therein is your salvation. Also and so, fear Allah and leave falsehood, though therein is your salvation. For in reality, therein is your destruction. In this conversation, dear friends, that Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam has with his companions,
He tells them in the first part of the conversation, of course, to fear Allah and to say the truth, even though your destruction seems to be there. Now, this destruction is a superficial destruction. It means you might lose your job, or you might lose your status, your position. You might incur a loss in the apparent and the manifest and the zahir level. But Imam al-Kadhim says that when you say the truth, even though apparently it might seem that you are going to lead to your destruction, in reality you are leading to your salvation. And then in the second part, again he says, fear Allah. But this time he talks about falsehood. And Imam al-Kadhim says that one must leave falsehood, even though manifestly or openly or apparently, in the outer form, it might seem like you are going to attain salvation. But in reality, it is going to lead to your destruction. So sometimes we think that if we lie, or we create or support some sort of falsehood, that we might be able to save ourselves or attain some kind of material or physical salvation. But in reality, falsehood will always lead to destruction, and truth will always lead to salvation. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
In Islamic ethics, we are told there are two powerful emotions that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given to us. There are two emotions which are considered to be the basis of every other emotion that we have in our system. One is known as ghazab, anger. And this is where Al-Kadhimul Ghayz refers to. But there is other side of it. The second emotion is known as shahwat, desire, greed. Just as we have to restrain and control the emotion which is known as ghadab and anger, similarly, and this is where I would like to slightly digress, but inspired from the title of the Imam, talk about the other side of it. That when it comes to the issue of shahwat, the desire that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created within us, that is not to be totally suppressed. It can be fulfilled, but the balance is that it should be fulfilled within the bounds of the Islamic Sharia. And when we look at this issue, you know, normally the ulama of akhlaq, they talk about shahwat in two forms. This is just a very general division that we are doing. One is on the issue of food and drinks, and the other is as far as the sexual desires are concerned. We have to restrain. Nobody says, Islam says that don't eat and drink. No. We have to eat and drink. But we should see, is it halal and tayyib or not? Is it halal and healthy or not? Similarly, when we talk about the issue of sexual desires, we have to make sure that it is fulfilled according to the ways in which Islam has allowed it. And the rulings and the teachings are very clear about this issue.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN. Call of Islam page
where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight. George Floyd's murder set in motion shockwaves that touched almost every aspect of American society. But under core issues of police violence and police accountability, very little is different. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalists Tim Arango and Julia Hayward. The piece is titled, Despite Uproar Over Floyd's Death, the Number of Fatal Encounters with Police Hasn't Changed. For the second time this year, a jury in Minneapolis has ruled against a former police officer for killing a black man. Like the conviction of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, the verdict on Thursday, 23rd of December, against Kimberly Potter on two counts of manslaughter for the shooting death of Daunte Wright during a traffic stop represented an unusual decision to send a police officer to prison. And yet, despite the two high-profile convictions in Minneapolis, a review of the data a year and a half after America's summer of protest shows that accountability for police officers who kill remains elusive, and that the sheer numbers of people killed in encounters with police have remained steady at an alarming level. The murder of George Floyd on a Minneapolis street corner drew millions to the streets in protest and set off a national reassessment on race that touches almost every aspect of American life, from corporate boardrooms to sports nicknames. But under core issues that set off the social unrest in the first place, that is police violence and police accountability, very little has changed. Since Mr. Floyd's death in May of last year, 1,646 people have been killed by the police, or about three people per day on average, according to Mapping Police Violence, a non-profit organization that tracks people killed by the police. Although murder or manslaughter charges against police officers have increased this year, criminal charges, much less convictions, remain exceptionally rare. That underscores both the benefit of the doubt usually accorded law officers who are often making life or death decisions in a split second, and the way the law and the power of police unions often protect officers, say activists and legal experts. The convictions of both Derek Chauvin, the former Minneapolis police officer who was captured on an excruciating bystander video pinning George Floyd to the ground for more than 9 minutes as he gasped for air, and Kimberly Potter strike some experts as tantalizing glimpses of a legal system in flux. Kimberly Potter's case in particular reflected the kind of split-second decision she mistakenly used her gun instead of her taser after Daunte Wright tried to flee an arrest that jurors usually excuse even when something goes horribly wrong. Chris Uggan, a sociology and law professor at the University of Minnesota, said that even though the number of people killed by police remained prevalent, high-profile cases could still send a message to the police. The probability of punishment is not zero, he said, so it moves the needle to some degree, and it can certainly affect the behaviors of police officers. But many experts are reluctant to read too much into a few isolated cases carried out in the glare of media scrutiny. Criminal trials are not designed to be instruments of change, said Paul Butler, a professor at Georgetown University Law Center and a former prosecutor. Criminal trials are about bringing individual wrongdoers to justice. So while there have been high-profile prosecutions of police officers for killing black people, that doesn't in and of itself lead to the kind of systematic reform that might reduce police violence. Philip Stinson, a criminal justice professor at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, who tracks police criminal charges and convictions, said Kimberly Potter was the first female police officer convicted of a murder or manslaughter charge in an on-duty shooting incident since 2005. He said he believed that the number of deaths from excessive police force was higher than what was recorded and reflected in news coverage. Many police officers exhibit a fear of black people, he said. Until we can address that, it is very difficult to bring about meaningful reforms. Gloria J. Brown Marshall, a constitutional law professor at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, said accountability also needed to be aimed at prosecutors who gave police officers carte blanche for a century until the recent show of public outrage. Change is not likely to come anytime soon, she said. In these individual cases, justice won in the end, she said, but there is a lot of work that still needs to be done. Jim Pascoe, the executive director of the National Fraternal Order of Police, said the rarity of criminal charges against police officers doesn't indicate a lack of accountability, but simply reflects that the vast majority of police shootings are lawful, with many occurring under dangerous circumstances where police officers have to make quick life or death decisions. There has been no finding of fault against police officers in many of the other recent high-profile cases of people killed in encounters with the police. Less than 3 weeks after the murder of George Floyd, an officer in Atlanta, Georgia, fatally shot a black man named Rayshard Brooks, who was fleeing a Wendy's parking lot after taking a taser from the officer's partner and firing it at him. The killing in Atlanta, Georgia, like that of George Floyd's, was captured on bystander video and drew protesters, adding to the demands for justice and accountability over the number of African Americans killed by the police. And about 2 months before George Floyd's murder, Breonna Taylor was killed in her Louisville apartment during a botched police raid that targeted an ex-boyfriend for alleged drug crimes. Her name, too, became familiar to millions of Americans. Yet the police officers involved in the Breonna Taylor case have largely been cleared, even as federal authorities continue to investigate. And in Atlanta, Georgia, Rayshard Brooks's case stalled this summer as it was passed to a third prosecutor, who is starting the investigation all over again. The police officer who shot Rayshard Brooks has been charged with murder, but there is no timeline for a trial. We are taking a fresh look at it and starting from day one, said Pete Skandalakis, a special prosecutor in Georgia who took over the case. He added that he could not predict when the case would see a courtroom. That has left Rayshard Brooks's family wondering if they will ever see justice. "I think we're all just lost right now," said Chris Stewart, a lawyer who represents the Brooks family. "We don't know what to think or what's going on." According to data kept by Philip Stinson and a research team at Bowling Green University in Ohio, 21 police officers this year have been charged with murder or manslaughter for an on-duty shooting, although 5 of the officers charged are for the same encounter, the killing in November of 2020 of a 15-year-old boy who was a suspect in an armed robbery. While this is an increase from the 16 police officers charged in 2020 and the highest number since Philip Stinton began compiling the data since 2005, it remains small next to the roughly 1,100 people killed by the police annually. Just as the pace of killing since George Floyd's death has remained largely unchanged, racial disparities have also stayed the same. Black people are still 2.5 to 3 times as likely as white people to be killed by a police officer, according to Mapping Police Violence. While Derek Chauvin's trial was underway in the spring, Daunte Wright's death at the hands of Kimberly Potter in Brooklyn Center, a Minneapolis suburb, set off new rounds of protests in the Twin Cities. And in the rest of America, the number of new cases of people killed in encounters with the police continued apace, some of them piercing the national consciousness and adding to the names protesters shouted in the streets. Among them were Adam Toledo, a 13-year-old Latino teenage boy who was killed by a Chicago police officer after running down a dark alleyway with a gun. And in Columbus, Ohio, shortly before the jury reached a decision in the Derek Chauvin trial, a 16-year-old black girl named Marcia Bryant was shot to death by an officer as she swung a knife at a young woman. A state agency investigated Marcia's death and in July turned its findings over to local prosecutors in Franklin County. At the time, the state attorney general said he expected it to take prosecutors several weeks to make a charging decision. But a spokeswoman for Gary Tyack, a county's top prosecutor, said the case was still under review 5 months later. More recently, at a high school football game in a suburb of Pennsylvania this fall, police officers opened fire amid a crowd after they heard gunshots, killing an 8-year-old black girl named Fanta Belitti. All of these cases remain under investigation, and no charges have been filed against the police officers involved. One of the reasons for Derek Chauvin's conviction was that the circumstances of the case differed so starkly from so many other cases in which police officers were cleared by prosecutors or by juries. There was no split-second decision made in an environment in which Derek Chauvin could argue that his life or those of other police officers was in danger. In the trial of Kimberly Potter, which played out in the same courtroom where Derek Chauvin was tried, her defense lawyers said Kimberly Potter acted reasonably in using force because she feared for the life of a fellow police officer, a scenario more emblematic of a typical police killing case. This time, though, that argument did not work.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of a speech delivered on February 17, 2022 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, via video conference with the participation of people from Tabriz and East Azerbaijan, commemorating the anniversary of the Tabriz uprising of February 18, 1978.
If Tabriz had not made that great move on February 18th, the tradition of holding 40-day commemorations and continuing the battle would not have started and become common for the Iranian nation. When the 40-day ceremony of the martyrs of Qom was commemorated in Tabriz on the initiative of the people there, it became a model. In various other cities in Yazd and Kerman and cities of Fars province and in various other areas, this movement started, and it brought the people to the arena of revolutionary activities, and therefore the presence of the people led to the victory of revolution. The victory of the revolution was due to the presence of the people in the arena and in the streets. This revolution was won neither by guns, nor by political games, nor by partisanship. It was won with the presence of the people, and the presence of the people was due to these movements, movements which started and were initiated in Tabriz. Therefore, all of us, including your dear people of Tabriz, should thank God that your move was blessed and led to the victory of the revolution.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Well, the February 18th Tabriz uprising is an event. Azerbaijan has gone through various events and throughout history from a few centuries ago onwards, as much as we can boldly say, from 3 or 4 centuries ago onwards, Azerbaijan has been a promoter of national unity and national resistance. In other words, Azerbaijan and Tabriz were a key point for the unity of the Iranian nation and an important center for training the Iranian people to withstand various incidents. This leads to great honors for this city and this province. Of course, the 29th of Bahman is a great honor for East Azerbaijan and Tabriz themselves. Another point which deserves mention is that one of the great advantages of Azerbaijan is that the flag of devotion to the Ahlul Bayt has always been in the hands of the Azerbaijan people.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms.
This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech.
The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship, and the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy, and that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine, these kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us, we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of